Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Release the beast and purge in our American streets. Your new founding fathers encourage your participation.
This is not a test. This is your emergency broadcast system announcing the commencement of the annual purge sanctioned by the U.S. government. Weapons of Class 4 and lower have been authorized for use during the purge. All other weapons are restricted. Government officials of ranking 10 have been granted immunity from the purge and shall not be harmed. Commencing at the siren, any and all crime, including murder, will be legal for 12 continuous hours. Police, fire, and emergency medical services will be unavailable until tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. when the purge concludes. Blessed be our new founding fathers and America, a nation reborn. May God be with you all.
Olson, who goes by the name Megatron on Twitter, wrote, "If we had a real-life purge, I would kill as many Mexicans as I could in one night. Hashtag, learn how to tip, you blanking blank."
Yeah, I was offended by it.
Olson's next-door neighbor says he, too, has worked in the restaurant industry, so he knows what it's like not to get a tip. But
if you're going to go on social media that brightly and say what she said, you need to be removed from that public position.
Generation Latino says it's no surprise that we're seeing comments like this in this political climate. The executive director says the vitriol and hate is real and adds that Latinos shouldn't have to face verbal and physical abuse in their own country that they love to do.
Indianapolis teen Jonathan Cruz is accused of killing three people in 4 days in a twisted crime spree that was inspired by the horror movie The Purge. The attacks appeared to be totally random. Cruz gunned down Billy Boyd and Jay Higginbottom on May 12th and murdered Jose Ruiz 3 days later. He is also accused of robbing a man at gunpoint on May 14th. In the purge, murder and all crimes are legal for 12 hours in an annual rite of violence. Cruz has been jailed since his May 16th arrest on felony charges from a confrontation with a teenage girl at Wendy's 2 days earlier. He had threatened the girl with a gun and kept her from leaving. Prosecutors say they will consider the death penalty.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, April 11, 2019. So I have been told. This is our book study session. Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism by suspected racist James Loewen. We are picking up. we are kind of at the end portion, I guess, of chapter six. It's difficult, or at least for me, it's difficult to follow along because the book does have chapters, but then those chapters are also subdivided. As opposed to just going from chapter to chapter to chapter, you're kind of going from subdivision as we move through the chapters. But we're kind of towards the end of chapter six. We'll get into chapter seven today. I want to say this book has such a wide amount of information spanning the country. So there's so many different locations that he's talking about. I would encourage folks to be mindful of different areas, because then you can pair that to things that are happening right now, just depending on, you know, the area or person that's being discussed. For example, now this week, white man, NBA player Kyle Korver, suspected racist. He played with LeBron James in Cleveland for a few years. I think he's in Utah now in the playoffs. But this white man, he wrote an article talking about racism in a really incorrect manner. I think it might be titled Privileged, super tacky. This is a ESPN publication. And so I began to investigate a little bit about Kyle Korver, because I tweeted, he's about to be the most popular man since John Brown, which is pretty much what it was. Like, whoopee, Kyle Korver is doing it to it, going to the playoffs, knocking down threes, and coming out here and putting it down about white privilege. Vomit. But I check, and Kyle Korver, he attended Pella, Iowa, or he attended high school in Pella, Iowa, P-E-L-L-A, Iowa. I checked. This area is mentioned in Sundown Towns as a likely sundown town. No Negroes in Kyle Korver's hometown. And I said, wow, that would be interesting, as opposed to him talking about, and this is a million, it's not just, you know, Tim Wise or Jane Ellen. This is a white man who gets paid millions of dollars to dribble a basketball. He doesn't even dribble, to just shoot a basketball, and he misses most of his shots, to tell me about white privilege. Tell us, what was it like growing up in a sundown town? Tell us about some of the basketball games, because he mentioned that last week in the book. Tell us about some of the basketball games. If a colored fella came to the gym, was he called a nigger? That I would be much more interested in. I don't know. I didn't even read the article once I saw the privilege. Somebody would have to tell me if he mentioned that, but I would much rather have a full-length essay on that, racist jokes that he heard. What was it like growing up in a town that didn't allow niggers? We'll proceed. Kyle Korver, if you're listening, let's get that article out at the end of the playoffs. Utah's not going to win it all. So once the playoffs done, that'll be your next assignment for the undefeated. Context of white supremacy. Sundown Towns, a hidden dimension of American racism, white supremacy. Audio segment number one.
The Nadir made Sundown Towns possible. Answering the other questions, why did so many towns go sundown? What caused one town to do so but not another isn't so easy. It's always hard to assign causes for large-scale historical movements, and all the more so when the movement entails attitudes and actions that are embarrassing or repugnant in retrospect. I suggest two kinds of underlying forces were at work. First, the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, changed. I'm referring to the deepening racism known as the nadir of race relations, of course, between 1890 and 1940. This change in our national culture affected towns all across America, but it didn't affect them equally. The second type of underlying social and cultural causes predisposed some towns, but not others, to go sundown. These factors included a democratic voting majority, mono-ethnic makeup, and strong labor movement. Such characteristics did not determine that a town would go sundown, but as the nadir deepened, African Americans in these towns lived on the knife edge. The actions of a few individuals on one side or the other often swayed the outcome. Even chance played a role. Chapter 2 analyzed how and why racism intensified after 1890 across the United States. Lynchings rose to their all-time high, the Ku Klux Klan was reborn as a national institution, and whites drove blacks from occupation after occupation. Causal factors underlying the nadir included the three I's: Indian Wars, increasing opposition to immigrants and imperialism, as well as the rise of social Darwinism to justify the opulence of the Gilded Age. Of course, the racism that had arisen earlier in our culture as a rationale for slavery was always a key underlying ingredient. If not for this intensification of white supremacy between 1890 and 1940, towns and suburbs across the North would never have been allowed to expel and exclude African Americans and others. The most obvious way that the nadir of race relations gave birth to sundown towns was in the changed response of governments when whites drove out African Americans. Two incidents in Anna, in southern Illinois, one before the nadir and one during it, highlight its impact. This book began with a mention of the 1909 lynching that led to the expulsion of African Americans from Anna. Chapter 7 tells that story in detail. But 1909 was not the first expulsion of African Americans from Anna Jonesboro, which had long been anti-black. In 1862, citizens of Union County had supported a new state constitutional provision: no Negro or mulatto shall migrate or settle in this state, by a vote of 1,583-98. Complaining because ex-slaves passed through the county going north on the Illinois Central Railroad, the Anna newspaper editor wrote, "We have laws prohibiting their settlement here." During the Civil War, Cairo was a place of refuge for African Americans from the lower Mississippi Valley. United States Army officers struggled to cope with the flood of refugees. In 1863, residents in and around Cobden, 6 miles north of Anna, agreed to take some of these men and women as workers in their apple orchards. Benjamin Fenton brought in about 40 African-American refugees to work on his farm. Whites from the Anna-Jonesboro area charged the orchard owners with unlawfully and willfully bringing slaves into the state of Illinois in order to free them, a violation of the old statewide racial exclusion law passed before the Civil War. Then a mob of about 25 men, led by an Anna doctor, visited Fenton and forced him to return his workers to Cairo. After the Anna mob drove the African-American farm workers from Union County in 1863, the army commander at Cairo, who'd let them go there in the first place, was outraged. He wrote that he'd have sent armed troops to protect them if the farmer who employed them had requested it. The military later arrested the mob leaders and imprisoned them for most of the rest of the war. But when Anna whites again drove out their black population in 1909, no one was ever arrested. The federal government did nothing. Neither did the state. Indeed, the times had shifted so much that there was no thought that either government might interfere. Nothing ever happened to the lynch mob in 1909 in Cairo, nor to the men who drove African Americans out of Anna. Although the increasing racism of the nadir was a necessary characteristic underlying the outbreak of sundown towns, it can't explain why one town went sundown while another did not. In Union County, for instance, the nadir can't explain why Anna drove out its African Americans in 1909 and has kept them out ever since, while Cobden, 5 miles north, has African American households to this day. Tautological causes. Most residents of sundown towns and counties are of little help when asked why their town's been all white for so long. They don't know about the nadir, and few ever think about the underlying causes of their town's racial policy, Instead, local historians often offer tautological or nonsensical explanations for their town's absence of African Americans. Typically, these alleged factors have nothing to do with race. Before planting the seedlings of the real causes, I need to clear out the underbrush of erroneous reasons that many people give to explain all white communities. The spokesman for a historical society in a Pennsylvania county explained its all-white demography with this sentence: "Most or all of our towns were white because the area attracted few blacks." The argument is airtight, of course, but circular. "There's never been much need for them" is another favorite. But how an area's need for new settlers comes with a racial label goes unexplained. "There wasn't work for what skills they had," said a local history expert from another Pennsylvania county, whose white population between 1900 and 1940 was mostly farmers and miners. But mining and farming were precisely the occupations engaged in by most African American men. The flip side of the lack of jobs theory is the notion that African Americans went to big cities because that's where the jobs were. "There were more jobs in Milwaukee," said several Wisconsin residents, trying to explain the increasing whiteness of mid-sized Wisconsin towns during the first half of the 20th century. But jobs in the cities likewise fails as a cause of sundown towns. Of course, Milwaukee does have more jobs than any other Wisconsin city. But there were jobs aplenty in smaller Wisconsin cities such as Appleton, Fond du Lac, and Oshkosh in the four counties surrounding Lake Winnebago. Indeed, those counties were urbanizing between 1890 and 1930. Precisely as their black population declined by 78%, their white population increased by 45%. From 149,514 to 216,143. Similarly, from 1900 to 1970, Granite City, Illinois, zoomed in population from 3,122 to 40,440, owing to skyrocketing employment, while its black population fell from 154 to 6. Obviously, these growing cities had an abundance of new jobs for whites. As well, it's important to understand that most jobs in big cities were flatly closed to African Americans throughout the nadir. Breweries in Milwaukee started to hire African Americans only in 1950. The city didn't employ a single black teacher until 1951, and its first major department store to hire an African American as a full-time sales clerk didn't do so until 1952. In northern cities, most jobs in construction were reserved for whites until the 1970s. So big city jobs weren't much of a draw, except in a few cities such as Detroit and Pittsburgh, where a sizable fraction of industrial jobs were open to African Americans. The claim that lack of jobs caused towns to go all white is rendered preposterous by those sundown towns where African Americans have been allowed to work but not to live. African Americans helped build Hoover Dam, but had to commute from Las Vegas to do it, while white workers and their families lived in Boulder City, a sundown town built just for them. African Americans helped build Kentucky Dam, but after they finished, their housing, Negro Village, was razed. They were booted out, and Marshall County, Kentucky, resumed being a sundown county. Today, African Americans commute from Haiti Heights, Missouri, to work in Paragould, Arkansas, from Peoria, Illinois to Pekin, and from Mattoon, Illinois to Effingham. African Americans care for patients at the Illinois State Mental Hospital in Anna, but live in Carroll and Cobden. Sundown towns such as Cullman, Alabama, and Heron, Illinois, have long been serviced during the day by domestics from nearby African American townships. Ford Motor Company located its largest single plant in Dearborn, Michigan, a sundown suburb. Thousands of African American car builders commuted to it every day from Detroit. In 1956, U.S. News and World Report estimated that at least 15,000 Negroes worked in Dearborn, but were barred completely and semi-officially from living there. More thousands commuted to a huge General Motors plant in neighboring Warren, but had to return home to Detroit when night fell. In 1972, 4,353 African Americans worked in Livonia, another sundown suburb of Detroit, but couldn't live there. Lack of jobs can hardly explain the absence of African Americans from any independent town, such as Paragould, or multi-class suburb, such as Dearborn, in which they work but don't live, because these towns house white workers who do the same jobs. Even more blatant have been those sundown towns that allowed African American laborers to sojourn in temporary housing on construction sites for the summer construction season, but wouldn't let them stay once the season was over. In fact, using lack of jobs to explain black absence often gets the causation directly backward. In 1943, the chairman of Illinois' Interracial Commission noted, "Many plants in towns where Negroes are not permitted to reside give that as an excuse for not hiring Negroes." Some theories emphasize social isolation. Why should African Americans move into out-of-the-way hamlets distant from the centers of African American population? In short, the lack of blacks was just natural, or resulted from historical coincidence. I began my research with this hypothesis, that most all-white towns never happened to draw any black residents, but it didn't hold up. Another near tautology lurks. African Americans didn't move in because few African Americans lived there to attract them. Before 1890, however, African Americans moved to counties and towns throughout America, even to isolated places such as northern Maine, northern Wisconsin, and Idaho, north of the Snake River Valley. Then, during the Great Retreat, they withdrew to the larger cities and a mere handful of small towns. Distance from the South, from African American population centers, or from major trade routes can't explain this pattern, because towns in Maine, Wisconsin, Idaho, and elsewhere were at least as isolated socially between 1865 and 1890. When African Americans were moving into them, as they were between 1890 and 1930, when African Americans were fleeing them. In other words, because social isolation can't explain the increases in black population in northern counties before 1890, it can't explain why those increases reversed after that date. Something different went on after 1890. Sundown suburbs are not natural, and not due to class. Social isolation has even been used to explain overwhelmingly white suburbs. Whites have imagined that African Americans prefer the excitement of the big city to such suburban values as homeownership, peace and quiet, tree-lined streets, and good school systems. This notion is absurd, as historian Andrew Weiss showed in 2004. Weiss summarized survey research as far back as the 1940s, finding no support for this stereotype. Among a sample of 600 middle-income black families in New York City in 1948, for example, 9 out of 10 wanted to buy their own homes, and 3 in 4 wanted to move to suburbia. Many African-American families have the same fervent desire for a patch of ground that white suburbanites manifest. Other whites seem to think it's somehow natural for blacks to live in the inner cities, whites in the outer suburbs. This idea is a component of what law professor John Boger calls the national sense that residential segregation is inescapable. Most African Americans arrived by train, goes this line of thought, and they're just taking a long time to move out from the vicinity of the train station. As soon as they make enough money, they too will move out to the suburbs. But the whiteness of our suburbs is not natural. Over and over, white academics, as well as residents of sundown suburbs, suggest that social class explains sundown suburbs, if not independent sundown towns. I couldn't live in Grosse Pointe either, one professor put it in 2002, referring to one of Detroit's richest suburbs, also one of its whitest. For all white suburbs to result from classism is seen as defensible, because classism is okay, since we all presumably have a reasonable, if not equal, chance to get into the upper class. This ideology is a form of social Darwinism. The best people wind up on top, and whites are smarter, better students, work harder at their jobs, etc. People who think like this don't see Grosse Pointe's whiteness as a white problem, but as a black problem. They haven't worked hard enough, etc., so they haven't accumulated enough wealth, and perhaps enough social connections and knowledge to crack these suburbs. This line of thought seems plausible. Segregation by class is an important component of suburbanization, and increasingly so. Residents of elite suburbs such as Grosse Pointe segregate on the basis of both race and class, and for the same reason. Being distant from African Americans and from lower class people conveys status. Nevertheless, the reasoning doesn't hold up for two reasons. First, it ignores history. People who think like this have no idea that as recently as the 1960s and 1970s, when today's mature adults were starting their careers, whites in much of the country flatly banned African Americans as a group from many occupations. Not just professions, but also jobs like construction work, department store clerk, flight attendant, and railroad engineer. Second, sundown suburbs simply don't result from class. Research by Michael Danielson points to a key flaw in the argument. The proportion of a metropolitan area's blacks in a suburb controlling for income is less than half the proportion of whites in that suburb, except for the handful of interracial suburbs. That is, if we tried to guess the number of African Americans in a suburb just using income, we'd always predict more than twice as many black people as actually lived there. Something's been keeping them out in addition to their class status. Conversely, a much higher proportion of poor white families live in suburbs compared to poor black families. If income were the crucial factor, then there'd be little difference by race in the distribution of the poor. Continuing with our Grosse Pointe example, in the Detroit metropolitan area, class has mattered even less, race even more than elsewhere in the nation, according to research by Carl Teuber. More than half of the white families in each income level, from very poor to very rich, lived in the suburbs, he found. Among blacks, only one-tenth of the families at each income level, including very rich, lived in the suburbs. In short, social class, at least as measured by income, made little difference in the level of suburbanization. Rich whites have been much more suburban than rich blacks. Poor whites have been much more suburban than poor blacks. Sundown suburbs with an industrial base, such as Dearborn, Warren, and Livonia around Detroit, have long employed African Americans, at least as janitors, but they couldn't spend the night. Some of these suburbs, like Livonia and Warren, are working class. Other sundown suburbs, like independent sundown towns, are multi-class. Houses in Dearborn in 1997 ranged from starter homes around $45,000 to executive homes for $800,000 and up. Social class simply can't explain the absence of African Americans from multi-class or working-class communities. Nor can it explain the absence of Jews from such elite suburbs as Kenilworth and Flossmoor, Illinois, and Darien, Connecticut. Sociologist Reynolds Farley and his associates used our old friend D, the index of dissimilarity, to compare the power of race to that of class. Specifically regarding Detroit, they observed, if household income alone determined where people lived, the index of dissimilarity would be 15, almost completely integrated, instead of 88, almost completely segregated. Instead, economic criteria account for little of the observed concentration of blacks in central cities and their relative absence from the suburbs. The current level of residential segregation must be attributed largely to action and attitudes, past and present, which have restricted the entry of blacks into predominantly white neighborhoods. Indeed, blaming the whiteness of elite sundown suburbs on their wealth actually reverses the causality of caste and class. It's mostly the other way around. Racial and religious exclusion came first, not class. Suburbs that kept out blacks and Jews became more prestigious, so they attracted the very rich. The absence of African Americans itself became a selling point, which in turn helped these suburbs become so affluent because houses there commanded higher prices. To this day, all white suburbs attract the very rich. 12 of the communities on Worth magazine's list of 50 richest towns were all white in 2000, or had just one or two African American families. Typically, they were all white first and became rich only when affluent families moved in. After 1959, for example, when Jews were let into La Jolla, California, a number of WASP families fled from La Jolla to Rancho Santa Fe, 15 miles north and inland from the beach. Now, Rancho Santa Fe is number 16 on Worth's list, well above La Jolla at number 85, based on median home price. In yet another way, blaming blacks for being poor as a cause of segregation reverses cause and effect. As Chapter 12 shows, residential segregation itself constrains and diminishes the cultural capital and social connections of African Americans, thus artificially decreasing their income and wealth. It won't do to then use blacks' lower income and wealth to explain residential segregation. Other nonsensical causes. Related to the isolation hypothesis is climate. A historical society leader in western Maryland explained why Garrett County had only a handful of African Americans when all other Maryland counties had at least 1,000. It's too cold here. Whites know that African Americans don't like cold weather, which explains why they didn't move to a given northern town or county. Persons making this claim have obviously never been to Detroit, where African Americans outnumber European Americans 3-1, yet winter punishes anyone not prepared for its rigors. Garrett County is hardly colder than Detroit. Hardly colder in 2002, for that matter, when I had the conversation, than it had been in 1890 when it had 185 African Americans. The fact that the very next county to the east had more than 1,000 African Americans, while Garrett County had at most one black household, is a dead giveaway. Such abrupt disparities can only result from different racial policies, not from factors such as climate. Counties in Maine or Wisconsin were also no warmer in 1865 to 1890, when African Americans were moving into them, than in 1890 to 1940, when they were moving out. Moreover, African Americans returned to most Wisconsin all-white towns between 1970 and 1990. Manitowoc, a sundown town that had just 2 African Americans in 1970, had 71 by 1990, and Oshkosh had a whopping 435, approaching 1% of its total population. The migration of African Americans to towns throughout Wisconsin after 1970, like their earlier arrival before 1890, underscores that something other than isolation or climate was required to force their departure between 1890 and 1940. Global warming, to the contrary, Wisconsin winters didn't turn noticeably warmer after 1970, when blacks were again moving into formerly all-white counties and towns across the state. Also related to isolation is the claim that independent sundown towns are miserable backwaters. Who'd want to live there? A white professor at Texas A&M University in Commerce suggested in 1999, referring to Cumbie, a small nearby sundown town. What a dump, a white woman from Buffalo said. There's nothing there, referring to nearby Tonawanda and North Tonawanda. To be sure, some sundown towns are small, isolated, and backward, hardly the stars to which rational Americans of any race would hitch their wagons. Cumbie, for example, is a dump. Moreover, during the 20th century, Americans of all races did migrate to cities, which they believed offered cultural as well as educational and economic opportunities lacking in small towns. Nevertheless, even to explain why towns as small, isolated, and backward as Cumbie have no African Americans, small, isolated, and backward won't do, because humans are unpredictable. People are always moving into and out of small towns in America, even into dying towns, for all kinds of reasons. So would African Americans if given a chance. Indeed, So did African Americans between 1865 and 1890. And in those places whose exclusionary policies have cracked, between 1980 or 1990 and 2005. The backwater explanation is rarely offered by residents of a town itself, because it puts down their town, and because they know that it isn't so bad that a family has to be irrational to move into it. Amazingly, I've heard this explanation given for whole regions, the Ozarks, straddling the Missouri-Arkansas line for nearly 300 miles, the Cumberland Plateau in eastern Tennessee and Kentucky, the Texas and Oklahoma panhandles, large swaths of southern Illinois and southern Indiana, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and parts of Appalachia. Who'd want to live there anyway? But implying that African Americans have been making rational, unconstrained choices to avoid such towns won't do, because they haven't been. Their choices have been constrained. Indeed, many of the people who supply these explanations do know that the place under discussion has kept out African Americans by policy. They put down the town or even the region not really to explain its whiteness, but merely to make it seem a problem not worth fixing. Moreover, backwater isolation certainly wasn't judged adequate by whites who lived in such isolated little towns as Cumbie or DeLand or Villa Grove, Illinois. They never relied on their town's smallness, backwardness or remoteness from black population centers to protect themselves from African Americans. Instead, taking care to pass ordinances, blow whistles, or engage in other acts, formal or informal, to keep them out. Furthermore, many all-white towns aren't isolated. Some are on important transportation routes, including Effingham, Illinois, or Tonawanda, New York. Some are themselves important manufacturing or educational centers, such as Appleton, Wisconsin, Niles, Ohio, or Norman, Oklahoma. Isolation and happenstance make even less sense as explanations for sundown suburbs, because some of America's whitest suburbs grew up right next to some of our blackest cities. All of these tautological and nonsensical causes, lack of skills, lack of jobs, social isolation, natural, social class, climate, avoidance of backwaters, share two characteristics. First, they minimize the problem. Second, they let white society off the hook for it, relying instead on individual choices by African Americans. In recent years, some social scientists, such as Abigail and Stephen Thernstrom, have increasingly relied upon individual decisions by African-American families to explain America's intractable residential segregation. Blacks don't want to live in an ocean of white faces, goes the reasoning. If we stop to think, however, sundown towns and suburbs can't possibly result from decisions by people of color who happily choose to live in black neighborhoods. For there would always be at least a few African Americans who'd choose to live in majority white neighborhoods, for some of the same reasons whites do. Better schooling, nicer parks, investment value, and social status, in the case of elite suburbs. Others would move for convenience. Some African Americans who care for patients in the mental hospital in Anna, Illinois, for example, might choose to live there. Still others would wind up in formerly white towns owing simply to the vagaries of fortune. voluntary choice simply can't explain what kept sundown towns and suburbs so white for so many decades. Some underlying historical and sociological causes do. We'll explore three: political ideology, white ethnic solidarity, and labor strife. Political ideology as a cause of sundown towns. From its inception, the Democratic Party was the white man's party. Today, it's hard for Americans to understand how racist the Democrats became during the nadir, especially since the two parties flip-flopped on this issue beginning in 1964. Historian Nicole Etchison writes that Midwestern Democrats supported what Chief Justice Taney said about black rights in Dred Scott, that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Some Republicans believed African Americans should have all the rights of citizenship, while others, including Abraham Lincoln, were not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, as Lincoln put it in Charleston, Illinois in 1858. As the Civil War progressed, Republican thinking about African Americans moved toward full equality. Democrats underwent no such ideological advance. In the Midwest, I found a striking correlation between counties or towns voting Democratic in the 1850s and driving out their African Americans half a century later. Almost every town on the Illinois River, for example, which stretches diagonally across Illinois from the Mississippi near St. Louis northeast toward Chicago, voted for the Democratic candidate for president in 1868. Except for Peoria. The same voting pattern held from at least 1856 to 1892. Between 1890 and 1930, almost every town along the river went sundown, except for Peoria. Why? The Illinois River Valley was settled mostly by Democrats from Kentucky and Tennessee. Many of them were exceptionally racist to begin with, having left Kentucky and Tennessee to avoid both slavery and black people. Being a Democrat played a still greater role owing to the continuing racism expressed by candidates of the Democratic Party. We can see this same pattern of white supremacy in county histories. In every county along the Illinois River, from the Mississippi River to La Salle, Peru, except one, local histories tell of substantial pro-Confederate sentiment during the Civil War. Moreover, treatments of the Civil War in these county histories, whether written in the late 19th century or as late as the 1980s, display a white perspective. They rarely mention slavery and say nothing about African Americans. Peoria, the largest city on the Illinois River, is the exception. The rhetoric in its late 19th century histories is profoundly different, even abolitionist. An 1880 Peoria history tells how Midwestern farmers ignored slavery in the 1850s. Immediately surrounded with peace and tranquility, they paid but little attention to the rumored plots and plans of those who lived and grew rich from the sweat and toil and blood and flesh of others, aye, even trafficked in the offspring of their own loins. Histories in Democratic counties would never use such language. Public history, as displayed on the landscape, shows the same pattern. Peoria dedicated a large Civil War monument shortly after the war ended. 30,000 people attended, and the 1880 account of the monument tells how it would commemorate for all time the names of the men who gave their lives in defense of the Union and of human rights. In Democratic counties, defense of the Union would rarely be conjoined with human rights. Peorians put up another Civil War monument a few years later in Springdale Cemetery, proclaiming liberty, justice, equality, pro patria. Equality would never secure a place on the landscape in a Democratic county. So it should come as no surprise that during the nadir, every town on the river except Peoria, from the hamlets of Calhoun County all the way up to La Salle, Peru, drove out or kept out African Americans. Towns in other parts of Illinois show the same relationship. When Anna Jonesboro expelled its black population in 1909, political background played a key role. Anna and Jonesboro were overwhelmingly Democratic, while Cobden was partly Republican. During the Civil War, Union County Democrats meeting in Jonesboro adopted a resolution protesting the introduction of the Negro into our midst and citing, with apprehension, the dangers of robbery and violence to be expected from such an addition to the community. So the 1909 expulsion of African Americans from Anna Jonesboro was neither novel nor surprising, nor was Cobden's relative tolerance. In central Illinois, Mattoon was Republican, in contrast to the next town to the northwest, Sullivan, seat of Moultrie County, highly Democratic. That political difference in 1860 translated to a high level of anti-black sentiment many decades later. Moultrie County had a few families of the colored race in 1880, according to an 1881 history, but only one African American was left by 1920. In the 1920s, the KKK burned crosses in Sullivan. Later, according to one oral history report, Sullivan wound up with a sign that read, "Nigger, don't let the sun set on your ass." Mattoon, while no race relations haven, has had a stable African-American community for many decades. This pattern, Republican areas in the 1850s remaining interracial in the nadir, Democratic areas going all white, wasn't just true for Illinois. It held throughout the North, including California and Oregon. To be sure, since Democrats called themselves the white man's party, it's somewhat tautological to cite Democratic voting majorities as a cause of white supremacy rather than as simply another manifestation of it. But not wholly. Americans were Democrats for many reasons, not just the party's racism, just as today Americans are Republicans for many reasons, not just the party's racism. Once an individual became a Democrat, however, perhaps owing to such non-racist reasons as attractive local leaders, one's ethnic group membership, or the Republicans' increasing support for prohibition, it was hard not to become more racist. After all, the party's songs, speeches, and platform positions usually included attacks on African Americans, along with charges that Republicans favored black rights, up to and including miscegenation, a word coined by Democratic politicos in 1863. A different pattern in the upland South. Many Unionist areas later expelled African Americans. political ideology played quite a different role in the South. Politically, the traditional South had been split between Democrats and Whigs in 1850, but with the disintegration of the Whig Party, it became more Democratic, and overwhelmingly so as the South seceded. But Democrats in the traditional South, where slavery had been strong, didn't try to drive African Americans out. Instead, they made money off their labor. The South also had areas, large and small, especially in the hills and mountains where slaves were few, that tried to stay with the Union. After the war, many of these Unionist areas voted Republican. Until the 1890s, they maintained fairly good relations with their small African-American populations, partly because African-Americans and white Republicans were political allies. In states where the Republican Party collapsed after the end of Reconstruction, some of these whites then supported third-party movements, such as the Readjusters in Virginia, the Union Labor Party in Arkansas, and the Populist Party across all the southern and border states, again, usually allied with black voters. After 1890, however, the nationwide tide of increasing white supremacy lapped at the valleys and mountains of the upland South. Like African Americans in Democratic towns in the Midwest and West, African Americans in these formerly Unionist or Republican areas now lived on a knife edge. Their town or county might go either way. Many went sundown. What happened to cause this shift? Between 1890 and 1910, it became increasingly clear that interracial political coalitions would no longer be viable in the South. Since neither the federal executive nor the Supreme Court did anything to interfere with the Mississippi plan for disfranchising African Americans legally, other states passed new constitutions emulating Mississippi's between 1890 and 1907. Now, white Republicans, readjusters, populists, or other anti-democratic factions had no black counterparts with whom to ally. Democrats also used violence to demonstrate that they would no longer permit blacks or Republicans to hold political office. The coup d'etat in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898 provided final proof. Now, no politics was possible in the South outside the Democratic Party. The Solid South wouldn't really break until after the 1965 Voting Rights Act undid the disfranchisement of the nadir period. What were whites in the non-traditional South to do? In the newly Solid South, it wouldn't pay to be anything but a Democrat. Allied with this Democratic resurgence, a wave of Confederate nationalism swept the southern and border states beginning shortly before 1890. No longer were Confederate leaders such as Jefferson Davis viewed with ambivalence, having led the South to defeat. Now they were seen as heroes. Now, indeed, the Confederate South had won, if not on the issue of secession, then on the matter of white supremacy. Now Confederate memorials went up across the South, even in counties in the non-traditional South that hadn't supported secession in 1860. In western Virginia and North Carolina, East Tennessee, northern Georgia and Alabama, North Texas, and much of Arkansas and Missouri, many formerly pro-Unionist whites changed their ideology to join this wave, now the winning side, often becoming hyper-Confederate and anti-black in the process. At the same time, A new type of Democratic politician arose, who professed to be pro-worker and pro-farmer, seemed not to be a tool of the aristocracy, and was rabidly anti-black. Jeff Davis in Arkansas, no relation to Jefferson Davis, was one example, as was James K. Vardaman in Mississippi, and Benjamin Pitchfork Ben Tillman in South Carolina. Now African Americans were stigmatized, apparently for good, and so were whites identified with them. Now more than ever, it was in whites' interest to distance themselves from blacks. So we find that precisely in counties where residents had questioned slavery before the Civil War and had been unionists during the conflict, whites now often seemed impelled to prove themselves ultra-Confederate and manifested the most robust anti-black fervor. Scott County, Tennessee, for example, had been overwhelmingly unionist, sending 541 men to the United States Army and just 19 to the Confederate Army. According to county historian Esther Sanderson, it was their strong nationalism and not their love of the Negro that led them to fight desperately for the Union. They despised the slave system that had relegated them to the status of poor mountain whites. I believe Sanderson is right. Most Appalachian whites were anti-slavery, not pro-black. But Sanderson then goes on to suggest an aversion to the Negroes was an aftermath of the war, for many Union men considered slavery the main cause of the war. Here I part company with her, because post-war population statistics in Scott County showed no evidence of an aversion to the Negroes. 157 African Americans called Scott County home in 1880, and 366 in 1890. Moreover, Scott County voted overwhelmingly, 95%, for U.S. Grant for president in 1868. Who explicitly favored full rights for African Americans. Scott County didn't drive out its African Americans until around 1910, well into the nadir. By that time, interracial politics were over in Tennessee, at least on the statewide level. What happened in Northwest Alabama is still more graphic. During the Civil War, Winston County famously seceded from the Confederacy and declared itself the Free State of Winston, whereupon the Confederacy occupied the county by force. Many soldiers from the area deserted from the Confederate Army. Some even took the next step and enlisted in the Union Army. After the war, many whites joined the Union League, an organization formed to support the Republican Party and black rights, because former Confederate leaders were still persecuting them. During the nadir, however, Winston County found it expedient to lose the memory of its anti-slavery past, and while it didn't quite forget that many residents had supported the United States, its contemporary allegiance switched from blue to gray. Steve Suits grew up in Winston County in the 1950s. On a class visit to Shiloh Battlefield in Tennessee, he bought a blue Civil War cap. His classmates all bought gray, called him a damned Yankee, and meant it. As part of this switch, most of the county got rid of its African Americans in the 1890s. As late as 2002, except for Haleyville on its western edge, it wasn't clear that a black family could live peacefully in Winston County. Many other towns and counties in the non-traditional South that had been Unionist in the 1860s turned Confederate and went sundown at some point after 1890. Mayaca City, Florida, for example, inland from Sarasota, had many Union sympathizers during the Civil War, some of whom joined the United States Army, according to local historian Melissa Sue Brewer. After 1890, neo-Confederates seized control and substituted a wholly Confederate past. And in the 1930s, Mayaca City banished its African Americans. Although many counties in the Arkansas Ozarks opposed secession and harbored Unionists during the Civil War, every local history I read from Ozark counties, all written around 1890 or thereafter, tells of the war exclusively from the Confederate point of view. Most of these counties expelled their African Americans in the first two decades of the 20th century. Although not in the Ozarks, Grant County in central Arkansas also had many Unionists during the Civil War. During Reconstruction, it was named for one Union general, while Sheridan, its county seat, was named for another. Nevertheless, the Grant County Museum in Sheridan in 2002 had four different Confederate flags for sale and no U.S. flag. Sheridan got rid of its African Americans in 1954. Many counties in North Texas similarly opposed the Confederacy during the Civil War, but lost that heritage and drove out their African Americans in the 20th century. Herman, Missouri, on the Missouri River 70 miles west of St. Louis, showed perhaps the most striking transformation in racial ideology of any town in America. Mark Laws, who grew up nearby, notes that Herman started as a radical German colony and was an anti-slavery center in the heart of a slave state. It became the most important Republican stronghold in the state outside of St. Louis. In 1860, Gasconade County, of which Herman is the seat, cast 52% of its votes for Lincoln, 23% for Northern Democrat Stephen A. Douglas, 19% for John Bell, the Constitutional Union candidate, and just 6% for John Breckinridge, the Southern pro-slavery candidate, an astonishing proportion for Lincoln in a slave state. After the Civil War, blacks in the general area used Herman as the site for celebration of Emancipation Day for a number of years, according to Art Draper of the Gasconade County Historical Society. But, Draper wrote, early in the 20th century, the German school constituents voted not to integrate the schools by a margin of just one vote. After that, Herman's anti-racist idealism collapsed, and the county slid into exclusion. In Draper's words, the dominant conventional wisdom is that Herman was a sundown town, didn't allow them to stay overnight, could come and shop okay, but don't stay. Laws calls this slide unforgivably pathetic. Gasconade County teaches an important lesson about the power of the anti-black ideology of the Nader period. If racism could grow to dominate Herman, with its strong anti-slavery beginnings, it could dominate almost anywhere. Not every Unionist area in the southern and border states drove out its African Americans. Jones County, Mississippi, had been a center of Unionist activity. As with Winston, Confederates had to occupy it during the war. Jones County didn't exclude African Americans. Neither did most counties in West Virginia. We shall see in the next chapter that such intangibles as historical contingency and local leadership made a difference. But even in these areas, whites became far more racist during the Nadir than they had been during the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Context of white supremacy. I'm having to... I gotta read that last sentence again. My apologies. It says, but even in those, in these areas, whites became far more racist during the Nadir than they had been during the Civil War and Reconstruction. I'll have to think about that. So, Sundown Towns, audio segment number one. If you have questions, comments, gripes, you can dial in. There's a new number today. I was super confused. It took me a while to get my act together so that I could dial in properly. So there's a new number. Whites change things up. The new number, you need to change it if you have it locked in your phone or however you normally, if you dial live. The new number is 605-313-5164. New number for the program. I will update that on the descriptions and what have you so that it'll be written out correctly. But new number, 605-313-5164. Same code, 564-943-pound. *61 if you would like to participate. New number, one more time, 605-313-5164. The code is the same, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. You can also email untiljustice@gmail.com if you have comments and or questions. We will proceed. I think I'd asked before about thoughts about the narrator, and people did write in with their thoughts on the narrator, so that'll be one you can think about as we proceed. The word nonsense was used to describe some of the, I guess, explanations that are given for why there are no Negroes in a specific town or geographic location. Do folks have thoughts on the word or use of the word nonsense to describe some of these explanations, rationalizations for racist behavior? Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you have comments, questions on the first portion of the reading, proceed. Taking a few moments to get their notes together, notes on the first portion. Maybe they need a moment. I see hands up. I'll share a few while folks are getting their thoughts together from audio segment number one. That was a little longer. Spiffy section. It is kind of a large book, so slightly larger segment. Second audio segment will be normal size. I'll share a few notes while folks get, I guess, their comments, questions together from the first section. In fact, what I will do is read one of the footnotes. I don't even have to read my comments. I would encourage, if you have the book, try to read the footnotes as we're going along, or if you're reading it on your own, check out the footnotes because, number one, there are lots and lots of other sources cited. We were talking about, I forgot who it was, but mentioned they were going to try to pay attention to whether or not Mr. Lowen is referencing Black authors as we proceed. So if you're checking the footnotes, you can see who's being cited. But also, there's a lot of extra information, a lot of other books that can be checked out, things that you might want to follow up with. And he has really important just additional information that he includes. I said that footnote that I read before about they had the brothel that was with Black sex workers, and it was exclusively for white men. Black males were not allowed on the premises at any time, day or night. That was a footnote that included that. So this is footnote number 11, and this is in one of the subdivisions of chapter 6. It's talking about the excuse given that there would be no Black people in a specific region because they didn't have enough Black people. Like it was no Black people here, or maybe only one Black person. So that would not attract Black people to an area like that. Black people would prefer to be someplace that has a population of Black people there already. So footnote number 11 reads, sociologist Gordon Morgan suggests that African Americans left some Ozark counties in the early decades of the 20th century because they lacked the critical mass necessary to maintain the community. This is an aspect of social isolation and at first blush seems reasonable. In the Mississippi Chinese, I myself wrote, there will come a time of critical mass when a Chinese community, in any sense of the word, will prove unmaintainable. And I went on to predict a rapid drop in the population of Chinese Americans in the Mississippi Delta. The prediction came true after 1975, but the Chinese case was different. Economic and educational upward mobility led to geographic mobility for their children, while at the same time, the end of racial segregation in Mississippi eliminated the peculiar niche for Chinese Americans as a middleman minority, leaving no particular reason for new immigrants to enter the Delta. To be sure, when the African American population falls below a minimum, it becomes difficult to date or marry another African American or support a Black church. Until Missouri's schools desegregated well after 1954, 15 African American children were required before a school district had to provide a colored school, and 8 of high school age before it had to provide a high school. In the absence of a school for their children, some parents will certainly move. Morgan's hypothesis doubtless explains why some African Americans left, especially families with children seeking marriage mates. He believes it explains Huntsville, Arkansas, which had 15 Blacks in 1940 and just one in 1950, and it may. Critical mass also helps explain the departure of most of the remaining African Americans from Maryville, Missouri, after the 1931 lynching described in Chapter 7. We haven't got there yet. Most Blacks fled immediately, and enrollment at the colored school fell from 16 students to 6. 2 years later, it closed entirely, causing the Black population of Nottoway County to decline still further. But the root cause of Nottoway as a sundown county remains the lynching and subsequent threats to the Black community, not critical mass. And see, there's a book mentioned, A Death in the Heartland, or this isn't even a book, this is a paper. Similarly, critical mass theory does not explain why Black newcomers no longer entered counties across America after 1890 as they had earlier. If numbers alone could explain why a group leaves an area, then no new group would ever enter unless they could do so in mass. That is all one footnote. That's what I mean. I think it is worth checking some of the footnotes because there's a lot of important information. I can give out one more footnote that I thought was important in this section. When he was talking about the argument given that some of these sundown towns are in really small towns that are considered, this town is a dump, you know, it's nothing here. It's, you know, why would you want to move here anyway? Black people, there's no Black people here because there's no reason for them to be here. Okay, so he has this footnote is all about that argument. Footnote 23 says, inadvertently, This argument assumes that African Americans are much better at economic prognostication than whites, who seem not to have the common sense to avoid these backwaters. It also implies that their all-white status, meaning these little dump towns, their all-white status is not worth correcting. Either it results from blacks' rational choice, or if white residents do forbid their entrance, African Americans do well to avoid these towns anyway. Thought that one was important as well. I think there was at least one other important footnote, but I'll share that. Oh, yeah, because it was kind of lengthy. I'll share that one for later, I think. Yes, I'll share that one a little later. But there was one other really important footnote from this section. We'll save that one. Let's see. So do folks have enough time, folks who had thoughts, questions that they wanted to share?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Greetings, Gus, and greetings, Mr. Demery, and to all the callers on the line. I'll pull up my notes here real quick. Man, he said the nadir of race relations. Then he said why some towns went sundown. Towns did not go sundown. He should have said why some whites terrorized black people. But I think he's doing that on purpose to not, as the firefighter would say, speak directly to the issue and what's really happening, and to be to not really speak to the savagery of their actions. And he said a county slid into exclusion. Like, and then the one what you said about whites became more racist. I mean, just a lot of these things, just the way that he's talking in this book, I mean, he's just really practicing racism. A listener has some questions. Ask me some questions, and I wanted to share what these questions were. They gave me permission. So what the listener said was, I'm wondering what state was not a sundown town. Nearly every state was mentioned. And the author is careful not to say the whole of America wasn't safe for black people. I think he was practicing racism, just itemizing these small little towns one by one, instead of just calling the entire U.S. a sundown town. And I wonder what characteristics did a town have that wasn't a sundown town? Were they less anti-black? Were the people there less anti-black than the rest? Or did they not kill black people? He isn't actually saying what separates sundown towns from the towns that supposedly weren't. It's almost frustrating to listen to him skirt around it. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus. And thanks, Mr. Demery, for letting me go ahead. I'll mute my line.
Mr. Demery, for so patient. Might be muted. Yes, we can hear you now.
Yes, no problem. Yes, I'm enjoying the commentary. What struck me about the reading is this one word, tautology, supposed to be a formula of assertion that is true in every possible interpretation. And just the fact of him using that word in the sentence with nonsensical is incorrect in itself, unless he, you know, meant for this article the tautological causes to be you know, all nonsensical, because they're making excuses on why the towns were white. Some of them probably were folklore, You know, others were intentionally made up. The ones about no jobs and the jobs that was available, the very things that black people did. Too cold. There's a lot of people living in Detroit with sub-zero weather. A lot of times, you know, none of them holds any weight, except all white towns were preferred by whites, and that they created them, and they assumed that status was achieved by isolating themselves from black people. So they come up with all these sayings, like the one in Combi, Texas, about backwater towns. Black people don't want to live in these backwater towns, which some of that, you know, may have some bearing, but in this case, it has nothing to do with it. It's like comparing two different items. And he said the white people won't talk about it. They won't talk bad about the town. So that means that they're intentionally lying because, you know, we read a book once. It was about a big oak tree that was in the midst of town, and that particular tree had been used as a hanging, and then there was some controversy behind that. So the history goes on. They know what happened. And like Gus have mentioned several times, that some of these people, you know, may still be alive that were in those photographs at the lynchings. They'd be very old. But then the whites today, that would be their grandparents and great-grandparents. You know, they mentioned something, well, they used metaphors about letting whites off the hook, you know, by making up all these nonsensical excuses and then going into political parties, whereas we know that the former Democrats or the Dixiecrats, you know, is now supposedly the favorite party of blacks, and that Republicans are the white man's party now, other than the way that it used to be. And to answer your question earlier, I think the anti-black fervor was there all of the time. And so by him referring to the Nadir, and that there were some periods where this terrorism and horrible racism didn't exist, is just practicing racism. And last, I'll mention that there was a mention of Pitchfork Bill Tillman. And I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Context of white supremacy. Much obliged, Ivy and Mr. Dimry for Pitchfork. Ben Tillman, also in the Cows Book Club 2015, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy. Very important read. Stephen Kantrowitz explains a lot about how we got to our current president, methinks. The number, again, new number, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks did write in as well. I'll read at least one of the comments that we got from a listener, and then listener, we have the new number. I have to make sure that they have the information for the new number. Let's see, person who wrote in. Oh, we had a person who wrote in specifically about the narrator. Wow. Section one, I moved to Long Island in my teens and spent a large portion of my working life exploring the island. Before moving there, I assumed that it was mostly white, but after driving around and meeting and working with people, I became aware of all black
communities, in quotes, and even projects that seemed as old as the ones in New York City. The town that I lived in, Valley Stream, was a former sundown town. The subject is described in the documentary Strong Island 2017 on Netflix. The narrator. In regards to the narrator in the beginning, I found it really interesting how he says the word white by pronouncing the H. Apparently, that pronunciation is only used in southeastern U.S. and parts of the U.K. I can't tell if he was doing that on purpose or for the effect, because he doesn't seem to have a southern accent. The narrator's name is Norman Dietz, and according to an interview he did in 2005, he considers himself a well-spoken acrobat. I like to stir up laughter, all in quotes. I think he approaches this serious text with a wry sense of humor, possibly to keep readers engaged, but more likely to practice white supremacy. Interesting one to think on. Much obliged. Again, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll be reading this book for a while, so if you got comments, feel free to share. Mr. Demery Four mentioned deception. He said lie when he was giving some of his commentary. And I searched just around that word nonsense when he was talking about some of these reasons that will be given to justify white terrorism and excluding and or purging black people from a specific area and then not allowing niggers in the town. And in my view, if to say that it's nonsense, that is minimizing. Racism, white supremacy is practiced in a myriad of ways. It is not just a white person calling you nigger or a lynching. These nonsense reasons, these are deliberate acts of racism. These are not white people that are ignorant. Mr. Lowen said at the beginning of the book, he went up to a white person who was at a convenience store, not an Ivy League graduate who wrote a dissertation on the mistreatment and abuse of Negroes in 20th century America. He went up to a convenience store clerk. Could have been a high school dropout. Who knows? Edward Snowden. Do you know about sundown town? Oh, yeah. We know about the purging of the Negroes. White people are not ignorant about this. This is not just throwing out nonsense. Oh, Negroes don't like the cold. That's what it is. You know Negroes don't like cold. These are acts of racism. Oh, yes, we had a sign up that what he said in the book. How many different signs have we heard? I helped put the sign up. My grandfather painted it, as a matter of fact. That's not nonsense. And in my view, that is Mr. James Lowen practicing racism, white supremacy. It is the beginning of knowledge to call things by their proper name. And I think we would have a more accurate understanding of what it means to be white, to discontinue to assigning this to ignorance and folly, and just know this is actually one of the major ways that white people practice racism, white supremacy, is to lie about how they practice racism. That was the word that I looked for specifically, was lie. And keep it in mind, James Lowen, in addition to this book, he wrote Lies My Teacher Told Me. So you know that that is a major problem, people lying about things that have happened in this part of the world. Why would that same word not be invoked here, that white people often lie about these purges and the fact that they have deliberately terrorized black people and kept them out of geographic locations? Why not use the same indictment if it's true? Before I even move forward, I think to Ivy's question, or the listener that relayed the question to Ivy, he did say, I think, in the book early on when he was given the example that sometimes victims of racism had these little codes, like if a town had like palm in the name or white in the name, that that was likely a sundown town. And he was saying that the reason that these little codes or what have you, the reason that they worked is because sundown towns were so widespread. And I think he says that you could almost say that the entire country was a sundown town. I think he says that explicitly. And I think I highlighted it. You might have to give me a minute to go back and track it down, because it was early, or like a month ago when we were reading the book. But he did say that. And I think he said it at the same time that a listener said that, because it seemed like it was so widespread and throughout that you could just say that the whole of the country is a sundown town. And it seems he agrees. Let's see. Getting to specific things that I highlighted this week. That word tautological definitions, I think Mr. Demery Four first mentioned that term, I looked that word up as well to make sure I'm still learning and my vocabulary is not that grand. So I looked it up, and the definitions I got, the first one, saying the same thing twice in different words, generally considered to be a fault of style. Give you that one more time, because I think that's a different definition than the one Mr. Demery Ford gave us. Saying the same thing twice in different words, generally considered to be a fault of style. In the example that they give, they arrived one after the other in succession. That would be an example, tautology as a noun. I think that might be relevant because the example or the chapter where he brings that up when they're giving these when whites are lying as to why there are no black people, like when they say, well, there are no black people because there are no jobs. I think that might apply to tautological, where you're just saying the same thing. Both of these don't make sense, where he said sometimes it would be the reverse of that, where they would say, well, we don't have any jobs for Negroes here because no black people live here. Neither one is accurately getting to the same thing, but I mean, you could just reverse it and give all kinds of nonsense. I think that definition applies. You all can let me know if you don't think so, but I just wanted to include that as well. Let's see. From the same chapter, tautological. And again, I don't even think that you could put that up there with nonsense. It would have to be something that frames this as these are lies. White people are lying and giving totally ridiculous excuses to obscure and minimize acts of white supremacy, violence, terrorism against black people. And they know that these are total lies. There's no evidence to support this at all. And to show how widespread this pattern is of white people lying in this regard, and that this continues. It's not just with these purges. Let's see the next. I thought it was important how specific they were with these. That's why I said in 1862, citizens of Union County had supported a new state constitutional provision: no Negro or mulatto shall migrate or settle in this state, by a vote of 1,583-98. That is what domination looks like. This is in Illinois, not in the South or Mississippi, where you get that sort of overwhelming white supremacist sentiment, and they even identify the mulattoes, cowbell ring, as well. Now, continuing, the next subdivision, the metaphors, my goodness, I think some folks pointed that out as well. Before planting the seedlings of the real causes, I need to clear out the underbrush of erroneous reasons that many people give to explain all white communities. James Loewen, suspected race soldier, that sentence right there, in my view, is a willful act of white supremacy. What are you talking about? The underbrush of erroneous reasons? You mean the mountain of white lies about how black people have been mistreated? Make it plain, Mr. Loewen. You got all these degrees and what have you. We don't need a whole lot of flowery metaphors to cover up the savage antics of whites. That happens all, and he doesn't even identify white people explicitly. It's to explain the erroneous reasons that many people give. No. Be clear and make this an indictment. That's what it should be. This whole book is an indictment of white people, so let's make that a consistent theme in the text. Next, he says, African, I thought this was important where he talked about they would get the Negro labor, they would bring them in to work on the Hoover Dam or whatever it was, and, you know, even make temporary Nigger towns to house the black people. And then he said the African Americans helped build Kentucky Dam, but after they finished their housing, Negro Village was razed, they were booted out, and Marshall County, Kentucky resumed being a sundown town. That is, I think we've talked before about how sometimes whites can be friendly. They helped them build Negro Village, I'm sure. Whites can be nice, probably gave them some sort of paycheck or what have you while they worked to build the dam. Then once it's done, now we're back to, you know, what we normally do. Negroes, you got 5 hours to be out of town and don't come back. Great job building the dam, getting the boot. Let's see. Next, Yeah, both of those, in my view, these are acts of racism. He just said whites lying, whites being deceptive, master deceivers. Let's see. He says, when he was talking about all this meritocracy, and I mean that in line with the cheating scandal that's happening right now, that's what I mean. White people are not ignorant. I said that about the cheating scandal. White people know. I didn't do all this. I didn't get that 1,200 on the SATs. I wasn't in the honor society. I know I lied about all of that. I'm just coming out here practicing racism, just making up something to accuse the niggers of. I need a reason to come out here and justify why we have mistreated niggers. I just don't want to come out and say I just, enjoy practicing white supremacy. Just make it plain. He says whites are into all this Darwinism, lying, meritocracy, the niggers haven't worked hard enough, blah, blah, blah. He says this line of thought seems plausible. I highlighted that specifically. This is another one. James Lowen specifically, who might be listening to, at least he seems to be aware that we're reading his text. I think you're directly practicing racism, white supremacy. There's nothing plausible about this way of thinking, that niggers just haven't worked hard enough. That's why they're not in the white suburbs. White people know that's not the truth. Their grandfathers and grandmothers and aunts and uncles, you wrote the covenants to keep these niggers out. They're the ones who built the factories that said no niggers are going to work here. They're the ones who protested and bombed houses to make sure that the niggers don't live here. It's not plausible for any white person of any age. They just had right here in Washington State at Issaquah High School, these are white teens. They made that prom photo. It said, if I were black, I'd be picking cotton. Instead, I pick you. This was their funny racist joke for the prom. If whites at that level understand what it means to be a nigger, that means you're an exploited laborer. Even at 16, I know what that means. You've been branded a nigger. I know what your whole existence is supposed to be about. That already means, I know it's not plausible to sit here and say, oh, the niggers just haven't worked hard enough. That's why they don't live out here. James Lowen practicing racism deliberately, in my view, again. Let's see. And he comes right after he says that this line of thinking is plausible, he says people who think like this have no idea that as recently as the 1960s and 70s, when today's mature adults were starting their careers, whites in much of the country flatly banned African Americans as a group from many occupations. Who are you talking about doesn't know this? I've said this for decades. If you're talking about younger white people, you mean that they don't know about their parents and their parents' views on niggers? False. We just mentioned Dr. Joe Feagin. White people talk about racism all the time. I have learned that intimately with the yoga situation. Anyone who tells you that, they are lying. I don't know what white people are ignorant about how niggers have been treated in this part of the world, at least in the last 50 years, if not from a much broader perspective. Go back to that high school picking cotton. Next. I thought the whole portion about class, he could have made that a lot more direct as well. If it's so clearly, so explicitly, which he does say at points, like here, he says, in short, social class, at least as measured by income, made little difference in the level of suburbanization. Rich whites have been much more suburban than rich blacks. Poor whites have been much more suburban than poor blacks. There's so much confusion about class that gets brought up so many times. In my view, another way whites practice racism to cause confusion about what the problem is, white supremacy, racism, that the class point, I mean, that needs to be super explicit. In my view, he could have done a better job. He did have a few sentences that brought some clarity, but it should have been much more explicit and, in my view, shorter, because it's not a class problem at all. It's a nigger word. It's whites practicing racism against folks they say are niggers. That is the problem. Let's see. Thought it was important where he did make it clear the absence of African Americans itself becomes a selling point, which in turn helped these suburbs become so affluent because houses there commanded higher prices. I thought this was important just because I know where La Jolla is in California. It's on the way down Southern California, your way down to San Diego. When I lived in California, I just thought it was such an enchanted area. But he said, when Jews were let into La Jolla, California, a number of WASP families fled from La Jolla to Rancho Santa Fe, 15 miles north and inland from the beach. Now Rancho Santa Fe is number 16 on Worth's list, well above La Jolla at number 85, based on median home price. I thought that was a great way of quantifying white supremacy racism, and them saying, well, these folks we designate non-white, we're going to leave this area, and showing the economic, how white supremacy racism is rewarded. Other nonsensical call, and he has it twice. It's not even just one chapter, it's two chapters that use the term nonsense or nonsensical. Again, these are lies. Call it what it is, white lies. You got a whole nother book titled that way. Let's see. Next. I already read the footnote. Minimizing the problem, I thought that was important, where he was talking about all of these other white lies that they give. And he says all of these tautological and nonsensical causes, white lies, lack of skills, lack of jobs, social isolation, natural social class, climate, avoidance of backwaters, share two characteristics. First, they minimize the problem, white terrorism. Second, they let white society off the hook for it. I thought that was a bad metaphor. I thought it should be more clear. It fails to indict. That A word that we love to use, it fails to hold whites accountable. And you could have just left it right there. Add more to it, but it lets whites off the hook. It just sounds a little weak. We've been doing the book club for 6-7 years. Maybe I'm a little uppity with my skills critiquing literature at this. We got high standards. I think Harriet Washington, medical apartheid, would have hit that a little harder. Isabel Wilkerson, Warmth of Other Suns, I think she would have hit that a little harder. Dr. Welsing, I'm sure, would have hit that, when I say with much more accuracy, to really emphasize that that is important. When we lie about what whites have done to black people. And that's how, when you keep hearing all those excuses that black people are lazy, all of this is linked. When you keep hearing those excuses that niggas are lazy, that's why we don't read books. Niggas are lazy. That's why we don't live in the South. All of that is linked to, once you start to minimize, white people have terrorized black people in more ways than you can ever imagine. They don't even have enough books to catalog all of the terrorism. When that starts to be made explicit because it's true, I think then you can reduce some of the, you niggas are lazy, that's why you don't. And I'll stop there. Did we have any other folks who had comments they wanted to share? Let's see, retired firefighter, did you have comments? You should be with us, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. Probably not going to say anything that no one else has reported. I would say that white people have to control and dominate the narratives of things, even the words, and even when they are admitting to something such as practicing the practice of racism, they are going to lower the intensity of the identifications on who is doing what and how are they labeled. That's what they do, and I'm sure that the listeners and yourself have that understanding. Also, I thought it was interesting in the latter part of the first report, first reading, how whites were able to distinguish between the global system of racism, white supremacy, and the institution of slavery, as opposed to why they chose to be on the side of the quote-unquote union, because they were against the institution of slavery. It just goes to show you, and it confirms, as I hear you say over and over again, that in order to be white, you have to have an understanding of racism, white supremacy. They definitely understand that thoroughly. White people are liars. They will, even if they see where their adversary is not an adequate and intellectualizing with them, they would just bold-faced, quote-unquote, lie, similar to that commercial with the white quote-unquote child that was being asked, "Did you eat the cake?" And the white child has chocolate cake all over her face. That's a Welsing moment, and she's constantly stating, "No, I didn't have a slice of the cake," and it's chocolate all over her face. That's the epitome visualizing on how white people sometimes would just lie, and everybody knows that they're lying, but they would just lie anyway, because they have the power to divert anyone from challenging and or making some sort of counter move to their lying. They just do it anyway. And that's my report on the first reading. Thank you.
Much obliged. The last two comments I'll get before second audio, then if anybody else has another question or comment they would like to share, we should have time. He said, a different pattern in the upland South. He said, Mattoon, while no race relations haven, has had a stable African-American community for many decades. You cannot have a community, certainly not stable, but you cannot have a quote-unquote community in a system of white terrorism, where whites at any moment could come and decide that you have been purged from that area and it's nothing that could be done to stop it. That's not a community. Two, race relations again. We can't get the word lie. These are not just called what they are, white lies, but we do have even the suggestion of race relations. He says, while no race relations haven, what would that even be, a race relations haven? The next one, he says, white ethnic solidarity, that section. He says, after 1890, however, the nationwide tide of increasing white supremacy lapped at the valleys and mountains of the upland South. What does that mean? Are we talking about a dog panting? Are we talking about waters on the shore? What are we talking about? If we're talking about white people killing, raping, purging, terrorizing black people, I would prefer we make it plain and use the nonsense metaphors. Any other folks have comments?
I was just going to say, because I think, was your question, what do we think about him using the term nonsense to describe the excuses that whites were trying to use, you know, to deny what was going on?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, because I was going to say, you know, what you said, that, you know, that term nonsense to me just minimizes what they were doing, that they were practicing racism. And I mean, this is, I mean, to deny something like this, and it's something just so severe, what they were doing in terms of killing us and all these things that they were doing to keep us from certain areas, and to call the denials that they used nonsense as opposed to practicing racism. I mean, that's almost like saying them even driving us out, you know, and killing us to keep us out was like nonsense. If you're going to say that the excuses, you know, were nonsense, we're talking about terrorism here. So, yeah, I totally agree with you that that's not an accurate term, and I suspect that he knows that, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. If other folks are listening in, especially, I guess folks can think as well, that other definition of tautology or tautological. Tautology, the saying of the same thing twice in different words, generally considered to be a fault of style. Does that definition have any relevance for the way that it has been used in the text in the first audio segment? You can think on that one as well. So we're picking up, I believe we're on labor strife. I think that's where we left off. We did not get to white ethnic solidarity. That's, I think, where – oh, nope, yes, we did. next chapter. So, yes, labor strife. That's what we should be picking up at. James Lowen, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number 2.
White ethnic solidarity. White ethnic group membership also helps to predict which towns would expel their African Americans. Of course, ethnic group membership often went hand in hand with politics because the Democratic Party appealed more to most white immigrants. But ethnic group membership also made an independent difference in 3 ways. First, ethnic solidarity often led to sundown towns. When ethnic groups came to this country, first-generation immigrants from a country often lived together and worked together. They spoke the same language, shared the same culture, and planned to marry within the group. Often they came from one village in Italy to a village in, say, Vermont, where they quarried granite together, or from one county in Wales to a particular town in Wisconsin. They also banded together for protection from more established Americans, who often put them down and tried to take advantage of them. Whole towns became overwhelmingly Czech or German Mennonite or Italian, sometimes because the town's primary employer, perhaps a coal mine or a factory, had recruited its entire labor force from one place in Europe. It was only a short step from this kind of in-group to a town that looked upon any newcomer of a different heritage as an outsider. Such towns were more likely to keep out or drive out African Americans, since they already formed a tight, mono-ethnic in-group. To explain the startling paucity of African Americans in Cedar Falls, Iowa, for example, compared to neighboring Waterloo, historian Robert Niemeyer suggested that Cedar Falls was overwhelmingly Danish, while nearby Waterloo had a variety of ethnic groups, Germans, Danes, Norwegians, Irish, Italians, with no single dominant force. It was easier for them to accept Croatians, Greeks, Bulgarians, Polish, and Russian Jews, and ultimately, blacks. My impressionistic comparison of mono versus multi-ethnic communities in Texas, Illinois, and elsewhere persuades me that Niemeyer is right. Towns with more than one ethnic group were less likely to exclude African Americans than were mono-ethnic towns. Another predictor related to ethnic composition was the sheer size of the black community. African Americans did find some security in numbers. Second, some white ethnic groups wound up much more anti-black than others. Among mono-ethnic towns, WASP towns, especially elite suburbs, seem most likely to exclude, particularly after their residual Republican anti-racism wore off in the 1890s. German socialist towns such as Herman, Missouri, and perhaps Scandinavian and Finnish socialist areas such as Michigan's Upper Peninsula may also have excluded after their ideological anti-racism wore off. German Lutheran and Catholic towns, Irish towns, Polish towns, and Dutch and German Reformed towns also seem to have gone sundown frequently. Jews, Italians, and Mexicans were more open in suburbs and also in neighborhoods within cities. After studying northern cities in the 1920s, T.J. Wofter wrote, "Almost without exception, the groups which are most heavily mixed with Negroes in the North are Jewish and Italian. Those least mixed are the Irish and native white people." Even after World War II, according to a long-term black resident of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, police cars served informally as taxis, to take us away from Cabbage Hill, the German neighborhood, when the sun went down, back to the Jewish, Italian, Greek, African, American neighborhood that was home. Across the nation, when African Americans did move to previously white suburbs, often it was to majority Jewish neighborhoods. Unlike WASPs, Jewish Americans lacked the social power to keep blacks out, as Hillel Levine and Lawrence Harmon showed in the Boston area. So when brokers agreed to sell and bankers agreed to make loans to African Americans seeking homes in Jewish neighborhoods, Jews couldn't stop them. Many metropolitan associations of realtors kept out Jewish as well as black agents, making it more likely that Jews and blacks would deal with each other. Also, Jews weren't as unified in opposition to blacks as some other ethnic groups. Having faced discrimination based on race themselves, some Jews refused to discriminate. In Detroit, for example, Jews were suspicious of racial covenants, concerned that such provisions might be turned against them. Not only did this make houses available to African Americans, it also undercut public support in Jewish neighborhoods for the kind of violent response that sealed off many other ethnic communities against black would-be pioneers. Consequently, according to historian Charles Bright, blacks have historically followed the lines of Jewish settlement. The process left most WASP, Irish, and Polish suburbs all white for decades and helps explain the concentration of African Americans into just a handful of suburbs in each metropolitan area. Ironically, it also confirmed elite WASP suburbs in their anti-Semitism, one reason for which was their fear that Jews will let blacks in. Evidence in Chapter 14 will suggest that more recently, Mexicans have also been both less willing and less able to keep blacks out. Both of these groups absorbed less of a white privilege viewpoint, which came all too easily to other immigrants after they'd been in the United States for a decade or two. The case of Irish Americans merits further discussion. Certainly, the Irish faced discrimination throughout the 19th century. Often they shared slum neighborhoods and lowly occupations with African Americans. Why, then, did they wind up, in Woofter's words, least mixed with blacks, along with WASPs? Writing in 1843, John Finch noted the Irish animosity toward African Americans. "It is a curious fact that the Democratic Party, and particularly the poorer class of Irish immigrants in America, are greater enemies to the Negro population and greater advocates for the continuance of Negro slavery than any portion of the population in the free states." Finch correctly ascribed Irish racism to successful competition. They drove African Americans from occupation after occupation in eastern cities. Then, in the words of Noel Ignatieff, author of How the Irish Became White, "To avoid the taint of blackness, it was necessary that no Negro be allowed to work in occupations where Irish were to be found. Still better was to erase the memory that Afro-Americans had ever done those jobs." The third and final point about ethnic group membership is that white ethnic Americans rapidly became regular Americans, while African Americans were not allowed to. Even when the Swedish, Italian, Polish, or Greek American newcomers entered as strikebreakers, in competition with older groups, eventually the American part of their identity became more important than the foreign part. Owing to the restrictive 1924 Immigration Act, new white ethnics grew less common, so the communities of Swedish Americans, Italian Americans, Polish Americans, and Greek Americans grew less Swedish, Italian, Polish, or Greek. White ethnics lost their accents and changed their names. Anders Andersson, prototypical Swedish quarrier, became Michael Andersson, less Swedish and more American. His son, in turn, never went into the quarry, but learned to fix those new horseless carriages and soon ran an automobile dealership. His son went to college and became an engineer. Indeed, by the end of the nadir, around 1940, whites had coalesced as an in-group, except possibly Jews and Mexicans. Soon enough, the only place it mattered that anyone was Swedish-American was on public radio's Prairie Home Companion. By 2004, an Eastern European name was a source of mild amusement if it was somewhat long, like Brzezinski, but was otherwise regarded as American. So was its bearer, as white American. Even in multi-ethnic towns, African Americans increasingly served the function of America's primary out-group, spurring in-group solidarity among whites. Their very presence, or even better, their mandated absence, by definition grouped all European ethnics as white. White ethnic groups more and more distanced themselves from African Americans during the nadir, and even some multi-ethnic towns went sundown. The history of Granite City, Illinois, across the Mississippi from St. Louis, illustrates the process. Between 1900 and 1910, hundreds of new immigrants, mostly from Macedonia and Bulgaria, poured into Granite City. Poorly paid, they lived in pathetic squalor, ignorant of American institutions. According to a book published in 1971, Granite City's 75th Birthday. Nevertheless, Granite City at least tolerated and sometimes even welcomed these white ethnic group members. They were non-black, which was more important than being non-American. Precisely at this time, Granite City expelled its African Americans. The white ethnics had started at the bottom, in competition with African Americans, but driving the blacks from Granite City erased that memory over the years. Moreover, when WASP, Irish, Polish, Greek, Italian, and now Macedonian and Bulgarian Americans joined to expel or keep out African Americans around 1903, the whites were now united. No longer could Poles be used against Germans or Italians against Poles, and no longer could African Americans even live in the community. By 1971, Macedonian American and Bulgarian American children were fully accepted, while African Americans were still totally excluded. Historian Matthew Jacobson showed how whites nationally unified racially during the same period. Labor strife. Our discussion of ethnic groups as strike breakers has brought us to labor strife as an underlying historical and sociological reason for sundown towns. American labor history is replete with the use of outsiders as strike breakers. Capitalists often used white ethnic groups different from, and lower in status than, their workers who were on strike. Because these newer immigrants had little solidarity with the workers whose jobs they were taking, coal mine owners especially, and on occasion quarry and factory owners, used each successive ethnic group as strike breakers against the last. In Portland, Connecticut, in the 1870s, for example, Swedes broke into quarrying when Irish and German workers were on strike. 25 years later, Italians did the same thing to the Swedes. Over and over, all across the country, each new group came in as strike breakers vis-a-vis the former group. Always this generated inter-ethnic animosity. But when African Americans were the strike breakers, a special hostility came into play. having first gotten their toehold in America by being strikebreakers in many cases, white ethnics now reacted venomously to black strikebreakers. As historian Ronald Lewis put it, writing about Verdun and Panna, Illinois, not only were the imports scabs, they were black scabs, and the white miners displayed at least as much hostility to their color as to their status as strikebreakers. Only rarely did the more established group try to expel a white ethnic group en masse. Whites in West Frankfort, Illinois, did riot against Sicilians in 1920. Historian John Higgum describes the scene. During the night of August 5, 1920, and all through the following day, hundreds of people laden with clothing and household goods filled the roads leading out of West Frankfort, a mining town in southern Illinois. Back in town, their homes were burning. Mobs, bent on driving every foreigner from the area, surged through the streets. Foreigners of all descriptions were beaten on sight, although the Italian population was the chief objective. Time and again, the crowds burst into the Italian district, dragged cowering residents from their homes, clubbed and stoned them, and set fire to their dwellings. The havoc went on for 3 days, although 500 state troops were rushed to the scene. Terrible as it was, that scene was less vicious and less permanent than most expulsions of African Americans. Some of the Sicilians were willing to sacrifice their property interests for anything they can get, according to a report in the nearby Marion Daily Republican. Businessmen are discouraging that practice, assuring all the uneasy that everything will come out all right and they can live here in peace and quiet, so long as they are good and loyal citizens. Many returned as soon as the violence died. In the same riot, however, whites forced out all African Americans from West Frankfort. No one made them any assurances, and they went to stay, as a Franklin County history put it succinctly in 1942. In the 2000 census, West Frankfort had not one African-American household among its 8,196 people. Similarly, miners in Ziegler drove all Greek-Americans out of town at gunpoint and kept them out, but only for 2 days. Residents of Ziegler told me that African-Americans, on the other hand, were still unwelcome as of 2002. When African Americans were used as strikebreakers, if the strikers won, they typically drove all the black strikebreakers out of town. Often, all other African Americans became fair game at that point, as they sometimes did after a lynching, and the workers simply drove them all out, thus creating a sundown town. In Spring Valley in northern Illinois, the Italians had come in between 1886 and 1893, recruited by mine owners to depress the wages paid to the French and Belgians who'd preceded them. In 1895, the owners used African Americans to threaten the Italian Americans. Late in the evening of August 4, 1895, a mob of more than 800 Italian American miners marched from Spring Valley to the settlement of African-American miners 2 miles west of town, led by the Italian-American band as a sort of disguise. The residents, therefore, remained in their homes and didn't react to the oncoming mob, writes historian Felix Armfield, who then quotes the account in the New York Times. Italians fell upon them like a lot of Apache Indians. Men were dragged from their homes, clubbed, trampled upon, and made targets for the shotguns, rifles, and small arms that the mob had brought with them. The women were insulted, slapped, and two of them, while begging for mercy, were shot down and fatally injured. No one was safe from the mob. men, women, children, infants, the elderly, and even invalids were attacked. The rioting continued, and on the second day the Italian miners announced, "The black men must go." Writing in 1945, historians Arne Bontemps and Jack Conroy summarized, "Nobody knows exactly how many Negroes died before the tumult subsided, but as years went by, colored folks, at least, referred to the incident as the Spring Valley Massacre. The result was the expulsion not only of strikebreakers, but of all African Americans in Spring Valley." However, Spring Valley apparently remained sundown only briefly, because African Americans protested statewide, and the mine manager insisted on his right to hire black miners. Similar expulsions took place in Panna and Verdon in central Illinois in 1898. Miners at four coal mines in Panna had been promised the Springfield scale, 40 cents per ton, won by miners in nearby Springfield, to take effect April 1, 1898. They had been earning 33 cents. On April 1st, the owners reneged, so the workers struck. On May 25th, after negotiations, the owners offered 30 cents a ton. So at the next meeting, May 30th, the workers demanded 35 cents. On June 29th, mine workers announced they would bring in strikebreakers from Alabama. Union miners then surrounded the coal mines with mass picket lines, which kept the mines from opening. Eventually, with the help of police and many ordinary citizens deputized into the police, the owners reopened the mines, using African-American labor. On September 28th, in the words of Panna historian Millie Meyerholtz, "striking Union coal miners and imported Negroes engaged in a pitched battle on the main street. 100 shots were exchanged. 5 blacks and 1 bystander were hurt. No one was wounded in the Union ranks. Both sides then raised the ante. Miners from nearby towns, heavily armed, according to Meyerholtz, poured into Panna. Hundreds went east to intercept a train carrying 60 black miners from Indiana. The train was flagged down 2 miles west of Tower Hill by a large company of armed men whose faces were covered by handkerchiefs. The masked men boarded the train and, at point of gun, forced men, women, and children to unload. They marched them along the track to Tower Hill. The purpose was to place them on another train and send them back south. Meanwhile, state militia arrived in Panna on a train with 2 Gatling guns. September was marked by daily incidents. African Americans were never safe outside of the mine compound. Whites with clubs chased blacks down alleys and through yards and threw rocks at them. Some blacks went back south on trains. There was a daily passage of insults, slights, and shoves, which led to street brawls and secret means of revenge, according to Eleanor Burhorn, who wrote a master's thesis on the event. Each side antagonized the other. On October 12th, whites rioted at the mine in Verdon, 40 miles west, where African Americans were also working as strikebreakers. The union had been tipped off that additional black strikebreakers were on their way. When the 4-coach train came through Verdon, 600 miners lined the tracks and opened a deadly crossfire, killing 11 men, including 3 St. Louis detectives. On November 15th, the Verdon owners capitulated to the white miners. Verdon has kept out African Americans ever since, although in 2000 it had 1 black household. On November 25, 1898, Adjutant Gene Reese of the state militia made the wisest analysis of the Panna situation. To unionize the blacks is most reasonable to establish the wage scale. But the probabilities of its being carried out are few. The bitterness that's been engendered by the union's fight on the Alabama blacks is such that it's not probable that the blacks would listen to a union man under any circumstances. Then, too, the race question has entered into the fight to such an extent that it's not likely a movement to get these blacks into the union would meet with favor. Racism had poisoned the well, making it impossible for black and white miners to drink from any cup of solidarity. On April 10, 1899, a shootout between blacks and whites killed 7 people, including a union miner, 3 black men, a black woman, and a bystander, and wounding 15. In June, the Panna mine owners admitted defeat, too. They closed their mines, stranding their black miners without even train fare to get out of Panna. Eventually, 211 African Americans left to go west, perhaps to Kansas and Indian Territory, and 63 went back to Birmingham. Panna also drove out its other blacks, accepting 1 or 2 families, as we've seen, and became a sundown town complete with signs at the edge of town. Besides Panna and Verdon, many other communities trace their origins as sundown towns to a successful strike. Something darker may have happened in Minden Mines, Missouri, where mine operators brought African-American strikebreakers to their coal mine in about 1900. Marvin Van Gilder, author of a 1972 history of Barton County, recounts blandly, "Many of them died during their relatively brief residence at the mining camps, and a cemetery for the Negro community was established northwest of Minden Mines near the state line." Van Gilder doesn't explain why or how many of them died, but Minden Mines became a sundown town upon their demise, and probably remains so to this day. According to a staff member at the Missouri Southern State College, who grew up in the town, a black family moved in for a week in about 1987 and left under pressure. Another lived there for about 6 weeks in about 1990 and left after someone fired a gun at their home. In 2000, Minden Mines was still all white. Most shocking of all may be what happened in Ziegler, which has been a sundown town since a series of coal mine explosions between 1905 and 1909 killed dozens of black strikebreakers. Ziegler's a fascinating town, built in concentric circles by its founder, Joseph Leiter, in 1903, who owned its mine. In July 1904, 268 United Mine Workers, UMW, members walked out of the mine on strike. Leiter ordered them out of Ziegler, which he owned, and proceeded to fortify the town. He had an 8-foot-high wooden stockade built, 800 feet long and 400 feet wide, with a live wire on top, enclosing the mine and adjacent territory. Gun turrets were built at each corner of the stockade, and another adorned the roof of the mine office, located in the center of town. Each had a machine gun and a searchlight mounted on the mine tipple swept the town at night. Strikebreakers came in by train, but the union was often tipped off and opened fire on the trains before they got inside the fortified area. Most strikebreakers quit as soon as they saw the dangerous conditions facing them. Leiter hired more, Italians and others from Europe, and African Americans from Kentucky. The strike continued into the winter of 1904-1905. Night after night, guns blazed, in the words of Ziegler historian Alan Patton. Bullets ricocheted off buildings and dynamite blasts rocked the city. Leiter's fortress held, however, and by spring, many of the striking miners were seeking employment at other mines. Then, on April 3, 1905, the Ziegler mine blew up. 50 bodies were eventually retrieved, but the remains of some miners were never recovered. The Ziegler mine endured at least 3 more catastrophes. On November 4, 1908, it had a fire. On January 10, 1909, 26 miners were killed in another explosion, and a third explosion a month later killed 3 more. Finally, Leiter gave up and sold the mine to another owner, who signed with the UMW. What caused the disasters? The most intriguing account was written in 1953 by Ruby Goodwin, a major figure in neighboring DuQuoin's black community. In her memoir, It's Good to Be Black, she tells in detail how a black miner walked boldly up to the office and applied for a job. He turned out to be an expert shot firer from upstate and a union stalwart. If anyone had been watching, they would have seen him climb up the ladder and get into a waiting surrey just a few minutes before the explosion. Goodwin's account intrigues because she is both African-American and a devotee of the UMW. For decades, the only major union that recruited black members. So she's sympathetic to the murder of 50 to 100 African-American miners because it preserved an interracial union. Also, no argument can be made with one statement she makes. The miners knew that the explosion was not untimely. It was timed to perfection. Unfortunately, neither Patton nor historian Paul Angle, who also treated Ziegler, discuss Goodwin's account. Oral tradition today in the white community in Ziegler and in the black community in DuQuoin agrees with her, holding that the dead miners were mostly black and that one explosion, the first, was set by union miners. It's this story that Ziegler residents still told me in 2002 to explain its all-white tradition. As with ethnicity, labor strife as an underlying cause of sundown towns shares some overlap with politics. Workers, especially union members, were more likely to be Democrats, an alliance that helped make some of them more racist, just as capitalists' alliance with the Republican Party helped make some of them less racist for a time. Indeed, I'd argue that racism as a cultural element in the labor movement was more important in causing a town to go sundown than the presence or absence of black strikebreakers as a specific causal variable. Political scientist John Peterson agrees, pointing out that African-American workers joined unions in large numbers whenever they were treated equally. Thus, union exclusion usually preceded and facilitated the use of black strikebreakers. In 1894, American Federation of Labor, AFL, head Samuel Gompers allowed unions to join his organization that were white only, and most AFL unions proceeded to go all white. As they achieved power during the next 30 years, unions shut blacks out of railroad employment, from construction, and in some places from meatpacking, lumber, and mining as well. After 1900, Gompers repeatedly made racist speeches attacking African Americans, and union workers responded. Often, sundown towns resulted. Of course, not every union town went sundown. Neither did every democratic or mono-ethnic town. Not only did the actions taken by local leaders of both races come into play, but so did happenstance, whether something occurred in a given locale to induce white residents to question the right of African Americans, or another minority, to exist in their town. The next chapter will explore these immediate triggers, catalyzing incidents, usually of real or alleged black misbehavior, sometimes as inoffensive as a black boxing victory 1,000 miles away, that prompted whites in a given community to expel its entire black population.
And that will do it for this portion of James Loewen, Sundown Towns. We'll be back next Thursday for our next session. I guess that's section number 7 for the text. For folks, if you dialed in, if you have questions, comments, things that stood out, something that you didn't understand, number to dial, new number, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. With that, we'll get to the phone lines. If you did not get to participate at all, if you had a question, comment, something stood out, and you didn't get to chime in at all during the first audio segment, you should definitely get your hand up really right now. We have about 30 minutes left in the program. Do not wait till the last moment. Go ahead, get a hand up, and we will get your thoughts. All the folks who are with us with a hand up, retired firefighter Mr. Demery Four, Ivy, lines are open. I'll look. I see other hands. We will add you promptly. Let's see, our caller at 9029. Did you have commentary? 9029.
Peace, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. I'm trying to follow and catch up with a lot of the reading. I've missed it, been a little preoccupied, and I'm glad I got a chance to listen to this. I was up on page 155, and just really interesting, the separation within quote unquote white people as well, but then also they threw Mexicans in there, which I thought was very interesting. And this passage is almost without exception, the groups which are most heavily mixed with Negroes in the North are Jewish and Italian. Those least mixed are Irish and Native white people. Even after World War II, according to a long-term black resident, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, police cars served informally as taxis to take us to Cabbage Hill, the German neighborhood when the sun went down. I just, you know, there was a little bit more there, but I was just really, really sets a little bit of precedence when it comes to up north, being myself in New York City, the relationship between non-white people and Jewish people, as well as Italians. And people will make the argument quite often that New York itself is pretty much run, the city, run predominantly by Jews and so-called Jews and Italians. But also the fact that Mexicans also would prefer to keep us out, I thought was very interesting as well. And I think there was a book that you might have read in the book club or had somebody come and speak about, and it's brought up here how the Irish became white. I'm not sure if you actually read that book or you have the author. I know I listened to a podcast in regards to that, or it might have been the other one, how Jews became white. I'm not sure which one. Following 157, top page, even in multi-ethnic towns, African Americans increasingly served the function of America's primary out-group, spurring an in-group solidarity among whites. Their very presence, or even better, their mandated absence by definition, grouped all European ethnics as white. I think it's just interesting how no matter what so-called group of white people they label themselves as soon as they came here and landed, they immediately went in a protocol and understood like, oh, okay, treat the niggers bad and we're in with everybody else. And that's all that everybody else did. Not one of the groups stepped back and actually said, you know what, this is essentially wrong. We've been treated unfairly too. We shouldn't do this to them. And it really is a telltale of exactly how we're somewhat at the stage we are today, where we're looking at the same type of behavior. Going down further and coming down to the labor strife issues, and this is the same page 157, where in Portland, Connecticut in 1870, for example, Swedes broke into quarry when Irish and German workers were on strike. And 25 years later, Italians did the same thing. And this goes to show the dynamic, the type of people they are as a whole, where their willingness to sell each other out and constantly bicker amongst each other. But as soon as the Negroes come in, they will like form together and literally not figuratively at all, put the hammer down, like with guns, rifles, all the violence necessary to oust us in any form or function. And that's just one of the themes I see. And even when they, again, especially when they're rioting against each other, it just goes to show you that we're so separate from their society and their mind's eyes, much less human beings, that they're not even thinking or fathoming of us in any form or faction. That's all I have for now. I have some more, but I'd like to hear the other callers. Thank you for your time. Peace.
Much obliged, good sir. Noel Ignatieff, guest on the Cows in 2009, Cows Decade, and specifically, Noel Ignatieff was a guest on the Cows at the time, given the Nipsey Hussle ceremony today. Noel Ignatieff was a guest on the program at the time that Michael Jackson's funeral was happening live. Other folks who dialed in who have commentary that they would like to share. Noel Ignatieff, how the Irish became white. Other folks who dialed in who have commentary they would like to share. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Yes, I noticed in this part of the reading, the focus was primarily on what I understand in history of some things that took place in this part of the world. The war that is called Civil War was the accumulation to violence of white people either staying within agriculture means of power as opposed to industrial. Apparently the industrial came to be the victor to comply with the general global system of racist white supremacy that had already engaged in that particular means of global control. And in turn, from there, they had to start recruiting other people who they knew white people were going to incorporate into being white in this part of the world from Europe. And at that time, Europe could afford to get rid of some people. And so in other words, the author of this book is keep mentioning about the late 18th century, early 20th century, the different methods, tactics, and strategies that the white supremacists went through, knowing that eventually it will settle into their favor, into the racist favor, eventually over time, with the idea of, you know, unions or not, strikes and that sort of thing. Primarily, the whole situation settled into itself as far as the system of white supremacy being on a more smooth and functional means, I would say somewhere in the latter part of the 1940s, after that second major battle called World War II. The whole idea of ethnic identification became less and less. They still do it, but primarily you hear the slogan, "I'm an American first." That actually is a facade for "I am white first." That's basically what they're talking about when they mention that particular slogan. So that's basically what I identify Arthur is speaking about during that period of time. And all of those people, Irish, quote-unquote, Italian, the ones who I noticed he never associates white with the people who call themselves Jews and who some people identify as quote-unquote Jews as though, you know, it's just a religion. We're talking about white people also. Primarily, they, you know, like I said, they the situation ironed out in the favor of the system of racist white supremacy, you know, just by the practice of racism. It didn't take long. We're talking about, what, less than 100 years where that taking place at, you know, in present time. You're even talking about situations with white females and white people primarily who are sexually confused that are now in similar situations in this part of the world. But hopefully I made some sense in what I was saying. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter Ivy and or Mr. Demery Four, if y'all had commentary.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Man, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Just like you pointed out, like when you read those metaphors, like, and like when I mentioned when he said the nadir of race relations, like, man, it's like he just really trying his hardest to just be so confusing and obscure. And it's like, you know, white people, they, you know, they have a better education because they took that, so they, I guess, wouldn't be as confused. But at the same time, it's almost like part of that is that he's doing that just to be able to say that he wrote this book, like, regardless of whether or not he's trying to be understood. And also it really, really, at least in my view and from what I'm hearing and the way that I'm taking it, it really serves to minimize the terrorism that he's speaking about when he's being just so unclear. You just don't really get it. Like, there's clarity around the word terrorism, for an example, which I believe you pointed out he only used one time. But just this obscure and really unnecessarily complicated words and phrases that he uses to describe, you know, this kicking out black people that's going on. It's just really something. he used the term discriminate. I think he said the Jews refuse to discriminate. He said some group of people. And it's like, no, it's not discrimination. And he mentioned about someone, it was more important for them to be non-black than to be non-American, I believe it was. And that stuck out. And he made a statement about how, I believe he said that whites, they shut down jobs that black people had or something. He did say that. But I think what I was going to say is that he talked about how some people was taking people's jobs. And I noticed that, you know, that's like a kind of a popular thing to say, and it has been for a while, just in general. And I would say, especially for victims of racism, no one takes anyone's jobs at all, because number one, victims of racism don't have any jobs. The white people took them. So what happens is, now white people are not taking each other's jobs. Like, they try to talk about, oh, Mexicans are taking black people jobs, or, you know, stuff like that. It's like, no, white people are taking these jobs and giving it to them and whoever else. It's like, you know, they're the ones who have the control of everything, and they distribute things. So, you know, no one needs to be in conflict about ultimately what white people are responsible for. He made a statement about, he said something darker happened. I can't remember what it was that he was referring to, but I remember he said that. So, you know, just demonizing darkness. Going back to the, you know, the shutdown jobs thing that I was saying earlier, he made a statement about that and said something about it was leaving black people stranded. It actually reminds me of an associate of mine, or someone that I guess you could say I'm familiar with. And she made a statement. She said that, because she's a singer, she said when she was signed to RCA, they shut down, she called it the urban department, I call it the black department, that they shut down the black department, and that, you know, left her without a job. And I just thought that was, I mean, it really stuck out. I just thought that was just really, I thought that was really cool. That, I think that's the word I want. I thought that was really cool, and actually had never heard about anything like that, I guess because I'm not an artist. So it's interesting to find out how white people practice racism in industries that you're not in, and how they become the way they are, and how all of these different shifts happen the way that they do. I mean, you see a lot of black people really are being replaced with people who are not black, and hip-hop and all these different types of things. So it's just interesting how white people, they practice racism. He made a statement about how white people were less racist for a time. Like, first of all, it's less racist. Again, this is a problem. This is racism, what you're saying, by you even making a statement like that. There's no such thing as that. And I would say this. It is very obvious that there's no such thing as less racist or more racist, just even in that statement itself, that he said that they were less racist for a time. So it's like white people are going to show their dedication to racism. I mean, they may practice it differently at different times, and then you may see different increases in particular practices. But racism itself, I mean, they're racist, and they're dedicated, and, you know, before long you will notice that. And I wanted to know also, because about the thing when he said about nonsense, when he said nonsense for, you know, these denials that they were having, I wonder when these sundown towns were, because I don't remember, because there was a time when, you know, like just probably 50 years ago, I mean, they was calling us niggas openly and everything else. So they weren't really trying to hide their racism. That's only not too long ago that they started doing that. And last thing I want to say is that, as has been mentioned a few times, it's like you have all of these cows, guests and things like that, with Matthew Jacobson being mentioned, and Noel Ignatieff, and then, you know, the Ben Tillman book that was studied on this program. And that was it. I'm in my line.
Much obliged. Mr. Demery Four, did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I noticed that, you know, he got into a lot of classifications, different classifications for white people, you know, and it seemed to cause some confusion because earlier, back on 138, you know, I think you made mention of, you know, the fact that he was mentioning real non-whites and what that really meant. But he mentioned back there that at the last sentence, even today, whites feel most strongly about differentiating themselves from African-Americans, not Jewish, Mexican, Native, or Asian-Americans. And then at one, excuse me, at one point, he mentioned that Mexican-Americans were considered white. And I can't remember any time in the U.S., you know, actually where Mexicans were considered white. Maybe, like Mr. Fuller said, that at a time considered honorary whites, you know, where they were given some privileges based upon their skin colors, but it's certainly not happening today. And we saw it played out, I guess some doctor was drug off of a plane. He just recently got a settlement for that, an Asian doctor. I, you know, can't see a white doctor being treated like that. And the way the Mexican Americans have been treated, you know, separating the families from the children, children from their mothers, you know, isolating these people. Over where he started mentioning all the different classifications of white, it seems to me that, you know, when he was talking about Czechs, German, Mennonites, Italians, I guess Swedes, Danish, one thing that they could all agree upon, and that was the anti-black sentiment. And I see I made a little note here, something about triggers. At the end of, I guess, chapter 6. Yeah. The next chapter will explore these immediate triggers, catalyzing incidents, usually of real or alleged black misbehavior, sometimes as inoffensive as a black boxing victory 1,000 miles away that prompt whites in a given community to expel an entire black population. It's like, it doesn't take much, you know, for them, you know, like they were saying at the football game, the high school kids were hollering, get the nigger, you know, to cause a trigger for them to go into that mob mentality and then start to terrorize and mistreat black people. I saw recently on a TV show, The Survivor, the last episode, the black lady, woman was there. She was doing pretty good in the show, but she said something that triggered them. And even her own teammates and everybody from the other tribe, all whites, got together on her and voted her off right in front of millions of people. It just shows you how quick that that trigger, you know, can happen. And all those whites getting together, like I said, one thing they could agree upon is that anti-black sentiment. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Ford. I'm going to include another footnote that I thought was important. He talked about the Ziegler mine explosion. This is the one where he quoted Ruby Goodwin, and they said that it was mysterious. There was some sort of explosion. A lot of the fatalities were black strike breakers at the mine. So this is footnote 54. He says, it isn't always clear, especially in the oral tradition, which disaster was which or who, by race and ethnicity, was blown up when. Historian Paul Engel claims most of the dead were Hungarians. Others think most of the casualties were African Americans. Historians also disagree with each other and with oral tradition as to the causes of the disasters without explaining adequately the basis for their positions. At the time, the mine management thought the strikers blew up the strike breakers, and a coroner's jury agreed. On the other hand, an inquiry by the state called it an accident and blamed it on gas buildup, and Engel and Patton agree. That's one. I guess one more I'll get in really quick. Of course, it has always been easier for the white industrialist or mine operator to be more tolerant on race than for white workers. It is in the capitalist's immediate interest to hire anyone who will work for lower wages. African Americans have long constituted a reserve army of unemployed and underemployed labor, often willing to work at lower pay than whites. Sometimes capitalists hired African Americans for this reason and worked them alongside whites in the same jobs for lower pay, which of course had a chilling effect on white workers' efforts to win higher wages. It's also in owners' interest to hire people who will work when others won't during a strike. Capitalists often found it easy to engage African Americans as strike breakers. Blacks had engage. Wow, I was going to try to just read this quick without pointing out, but I mean, that's so egregious. Capitalists often found it easy to engage African Americans as strike breakers. James Loewen, wow. That is disgraceful. I mean, wow. I would have preferred you just say capitalists often found it easy to engage niggers. I mean, really. It's so many things incorrect to engage. What does that even mean? Do you mean that whites often found it easier to exploit black laborers? Oh, I know what you're talking about. Engage African Americans? That is disgraceful. Deliberate white supremacy, in my view. Blacks had little solidarity with white workers and their unions, since those same unions had shut them out of skilled jobs and restricted union membership to whites only. Hiring the best person for the job, regardless of color, also fits with capitalist ethos and with the shards of anti-racist idealism that sometimes remained from the broken vessel of Republican abolitionism. Are you serious? Most important, after African Americans have been hired, the capitalist remains above his black employees as well as his white employees in social status, whereas the white worker is not above a black coworker. Thus, when the workplace integrates, the white worker is asked to give up white supremacy while the capitalist is not. I cannot believe we would have got through this session without that being included as a footnote. Like, that is a doozy of white supremacy on the part of the author, James Loewen, suspected race soldier. I mean, it would take about 30 minutes for me to break down what is in error. If a white person is hiring a black person and paying him less than a white person, you're not a capitalist. You're a racist. Follow logic. What? Wow, that footnote, I could spend the rest of the program just breaking down the footnote and all of the elements of white supremacy to get that footnote constructed. And again, Mr. Fuller, I think he said consistently, the master capitalists in a system of white supremacy, white supremacists, just following logic. Back to my footnotes. Let's see if I can get through these in a timely manner. Oh, man, Mr. Loewen was just, the racism was flowing this week. Chapter, he says, Mexicans have also been less willing and less able to keep blacks out. Both of these groups, Mexicans and Jews, absorbed less of a white privilege, and he has that in quotes, viewpoint. What does that mean? Less of a white terrorist viewpoint, and they had less power to enact that viewpoint? Oh, okay, now that's a little more. I have no idea what that even means. Disgraceful, and again, I think that's a deliberate act of white supremacy every time someone classified as white invokes the term white privilege to discuss this problem. Noel Ignatieff, guest on the program. Let's see. The whites were now united. I say the Voltron effect. Another illustration. Individuals classified as white. They even changed it. They had all of these people, Irish, Pole, Greek, Italian, who were not classified as white. They were able to galvanize under mistreating Negroes. Matthew Jacobson, Ivy pointed out, guest on the program. 2009, September. I thought it was important. The Sicilians, they talked about the mob to expel Sicilians when they were not classified as white. Think The Godfather. But he says that they were exposed to less violence, less vicious, and it was less permanent than the expulsions that were inflicted on black people. He says, oh, this scene, I thought this was so important, the detail, where he talks about this assault of so-called Italian Americans becoming white, in my view. He says, on August 4, 1895, a mob of more than 800 Italian American miners marched from Spring Valley to the settlement of African American miners 2 miles west of town, led by an Italian American band as a sort of disguise. The residents therefore remained in their homes and did not react to the oncoming mob, writes historian Felix Armfield, who then quotes the account in the New York Times. And it goes on to give the detail. Oh, Italians fell upon them like a lot of Apache Indians. I'm going to stop there just because that is quoted from the New York Times. And I would think this is contemporary, but that metaphor, like a lot of Apache Indians, that is a racist metaphor. I'm glad it's included to give the context, but wow, racist metaphor and from the New York Times. And then this attack, I mean, coordinated, the type of detailed coordinated violence will make it seem like it's a parade and it's really a terrorist assault on niggas. I mean, wow, that is incredible. I would love to learn more about this, just the different. And this is what gets minimized. This is what, when we talk about black people don't have this or black people don't read, when you've had these type of incidents happen hundreds of times throughout the country, the world, but we're just talking about this part of the world right now, that is a better, more accurate explanation for why things are the way they are, as opposed to, well, niggers are lazy and they just don't work hard, which is generally what I hear from white people and victims of racism, non-white people. Let's see. I heard the man not. I'll give maybe two more. They were discussing another one of the, or they are discussing this expulsion. And they say the men, women, infants, and elderly, even invalids, were attacked in the chaos. The rioting continued, and on the second day, the Italian miners announced the black men must go. Wow, Dr. Welsing, make it plain. Everybody was a threat, but again, Dr. Curry talked about that specifically, where all of the black people, elderly, children, males, females, everybody ends up being a victim of white terrorism. However, this is violence specifically focused. The black men must go. Let's see. The people that talked about black people fighting back, when he, next page over, he says, on September 28, in the words of PANA historian Millie Meyerholtz, striking union coal miners and imported Negroes engaged in a pitched battle on the main street. 100 shots were exchanged. That right there seems to be black people fighting back. Even though he comes out of quotes, he says 5 blacks and 1 bystander were hurt. No one was wounded in the union ranks. And now it seemed would be that there was lopsided, that black people didn't inflict any violence. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. Both sides then raised the ante. Miners from nearby towns, heavily armed, according to Meyerholtz, poured into Panna. Hundreds went east to intercept a train carrying 60 black miners from Indiana. He gives more detail from there about black people fighting back a little bit. Racism poisoned the well. The entire well is white supremacy racism, and that's another one that kind of makes it seem like it's a Hatfield and McCoy's type of thing, that black people and whites are feuding back and forth. That's not what this is at all. This is total terrorism, white terrorism. Something darker may have happened in Minamines, Missouri. I agreed with Ivy. That's those racist metaphors. This is the Ziegler account, I think, where it's not sure what happened. I will leave it there. As I said, I think Mr. Lewin has practiced racism in a number of ways in the text. I am appreciating getting the information and learning more details about areas that I didn't know. This happens frequently with white authors. You learn and you observe how they practice white supremacy racism. Lots of work for the brain computer. We'll be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Saturday for the compensatory call-in. If you have questions, thoughts, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged to the folks who dialed in. I hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. We'll have much to say coming up, compensatory call-in. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computer so that we can crank out solutions to the problem, not race relations, white terrorism, white supremacy. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.